I'm Amy Hall, and you're listening to the hashtag STRAsk podcast from Stand to Reason. And by the way, I hardly ever mention this, but we have a website. So if you didn't find us through the website, you should go take a look at str.org. You can see things written by me, by Greg, by all of our speakers.
Alan, Tim, John, and also guests that write for us as well. But we have lots and lots of videos, and the videos are fabulous. They're lots of fun. They're shorter vignettes, sometimes 3 or 4 or 5 minutes. And we all are doing these videos answering or short questions or use it to answer kinds of questions people ask or to make points that are valid and important. So you can just kind of imbibe from those short on and on and on. So just check that out too. That's great.
All right. So let's get into the questions. Here's one from Byron. Regarding Greg's view on tithing in the New Testament, what about Matthew 23:23, where Jesus says they should tithe along with not neglecting justice and mercy and faithfulness?
Yeah, that is a common passage that people bring up. Now, there's a very important consideration in this passage. Jesus is giving a talk. He's talking to the Jews and the Jewish leaders, okay? And he is instructing them about, is that Matthew 23 or is it 25? What is it?
Well, he said Matthew
23. Oh, that's the woe. Is that Matthew 23? Okay, yeah. What's the verse?
23.
Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint, dill, and cumin. Those are spices. So you strain at the gnat of even typing of a tithing, tenthing your spices. However, you've neglected the weightier provisions of the law. So you're now swallowing the camel, justice and mercy and faithfulness. But these are things you should have done without neglecting the others. So who is the you? Is the you the world? Anyone who's a believer? No, Jesus is talking to Jews. Why should Jews have tithed? Because they have a covenant with God, because the Mosaic covenant that required tithing. And when they didn't, they were in abrogation of that covenant. Incidentally, a tithing, which means to give a tenth, was something that happened multiple times in the calendar. And so when you actually add it all up, they're giving to the government, and there was no distinction between the government and the religious body. It was the religious body that was the government. And so the acts of tithing were ways of supporting the governing structure of the nation of Israel. It's better to think of it as taxation, to transfer the tithing obligation from the nation of Israel and what it was intended by God to do by covenant with them, just directly over to the church, is to take something out of the Mosaic law that doesn't apply to Gentiles and never applied to Gentiles and apply it to Gentiles illicitly. And if that's licit, if that's appropriate, then why not pull a whole bunch of other things out of the Mosaic law and apply them now to Gentiles? Well, we're not under the law. Well, then if we're not under the law, if that is not a governing, is that is not a document governing our behavior, then we are not under the moral obligation in the law to tithe either. Okay? And again, the tithing would entail a lot more than 10%. And note that pastors who make this incumbent upon the church, they want the church, they want the money for the operation of the church. It's not for the operation of the government. Do you see what I'm saying? In other words, the church is doing a much more restricted administrative job, so to speak, very important, and they do need financial help. But it's doing a much more restricted job than the nation of Israel. So this is all the background, okay? Now, if that's not compelling to people, which it ought to be because it's a really good argument, very good distinctions, I want them to turn back the page at the beginning of the chapter. And here I'm going to read the beginning of this discourse. Then Jesus spoke to the crowds and to his disciples, saying, the scribes and the Pharisees, same group of people in verse 23, right? Right? Verse 23, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, you hypocrites. The scribes and the Pharisees have seated themselves in the chair of Moses. So they are representing Moses, right? Therefore, verse 3, all that they tell you, do and observe. But don't do according to their deeds. They're hypocrites. They say one thing and do another. Do what they tell you to do as those seated in the chair of Moses. What Jesus is saying there is not just tithing is incumbent on the people to whom he's speaking, verse 23, but the entire Mosaic law, verse 3. So what we see in verse 23 is just a subset of the command he's giving in verse 3, and that is to observe the entire law of Moses. Now, pretty much everybody acknowledges that that's not right for New Testament Christians, especially Gentile Christians, who were never expected to observe the law of Moses unless they came underneath the authority of the Commonwealth of Israel. All right? So if 23 means we ought to be tithing, then verse 3 means, in the same sense, from the same person, in the same discourse, speaking to the exact same people, that we are obliged to keep the law that Moses gave. We are not obliged to keep the law that Moses gave, though, and therefore neither verse 3 nor verse 23 applies to us as New Covenant Christians.
Right, Greg, I think you're exactly right that he is talking to people who are under the Mosaic law. I think there are a lot of people out there who will hear what you're saying and say, well, then, yeah, we should be following the Mosaic law. So without getting into why we're not following the Mosaic law, I just want to mention a few articles on our website that explain why we're no longer under the Mosaic law. One of them is called Should Followers of Christ Observe the Torah? Another one is called Why We're Not Under the Mosaic Law. And then there's, Greg, what is the one that you wrote? There's one.
It's so forgettable, right?
You know, well, it's funny because I wrote these pieces and I send them out all the time because this comes up all the time. I get questions from people about this. There's
well,
very
there are
little
certain
understanding.
Movements within the church now mm-hmm. that are leaning back towards that kind of thing. And I think nothing. Well, the point I'm making is there's nothing in the law that we are obliged to do in virtue of being in the law. Okay, and that's because it's a contract made with God and Jews. Now there are universal moral obligations reflected in the Mosaic law that are also repeated in the New Testament, and that would be a clue that they're universal. But the law is a teacher. But it is not an obligation. It's a contract God made with Jews. That's the point of making that piece, but I can't remember the name of it.
Yeah, I found the name. It's How Does the Old Testament Law Apply to Christians Today?
Oh, okay.
So that's a really helpful one, too. And one last thing on this, in case people misunderstand, there certainly is a moral principle about giving that is spoken about a lot in the New Testament. So this doesn't mean we're not supposed to give. It just means that there's not a law about a specific 10% that applies here. In fact, Paul seems to say, you know, more sacrificially than 10%. So go ahead, Greg.
Well, I was just going to add to that he specifically says that we are not to give under obligation. That's explicit in the New Testament, but the Lord loves a cheerful giver. We're giving cheerfully from our heart. And as God has prospered us, okay, people say, see, as God has prospered us, 10%, whatever, he makes more, then we give more because 10% is 10% of a larger amount. No, that's not what he's getting at. That denies the thrust of the passage and the statement that we're not under obligation, not as an obligation, but from the cheerfulness of our heart. And I'll just tell you, I mean, we're working through end of year giving right now. I'm talking to lots of our partners at Stand to Reason, and it is so gratifying to know that these people love giving to Stand to Reason. because of the benefits they've gained, and they want to see us continue to do the good things that we do. That's the kind of giver that God wants, not one that's grudging and saying, oh, okay, I'm my 10%, I got to give this thing. But that's what happens when people follow the law. It's you like paying your taxes? No. Well, it's the same problem. You don't give voluntarily to the government. They're forcing you to pay the taxes. When you, but these are taxes. The tithe is a tax for the Old Testament system. It's the Commonwealth of Israel, including the religious community, that is being supported, not just the religious community.
And just one last thing in case people misunderstand. This doesn't mean that it's wrong for you to give 10%. We're not saying that you can't give 10%. If that's just a measure that you use to decide how you're going to work out your giving, that's completely fine. That's completely fine. It's up to you. It's a good place to start. It's a good measure just to keep yourself from slowly lessening and lessening.
Right.
You know, there's nothing wrong with it. It's just not the law. It's not the law that we're under.
Right. It is the criterion. And incidentally, the parachurch organizations, the word parachurch, like Standard Reason, for example, they're not parachurch, strictly speaking. We are Christians that are part of the church. We are not attached to a local church, but no one local church is any other local church, right? But they're still all part of the church. And the principle in the New Testament is that you give where you're being fed. And you can find that in Galatians chapter 6. And also Paul makes a reference, let him who teaches be worthy of double honor, you know, teach as well, be worthy of double honor. That's talking about finances there. And so there's the sense that when you're getting fed by someone in the church, then it's appropriate for you to participate financially with that person, individual group that's doing the feeding. And if it's principally your local church, you're getting fed there, then that's where you should be giving. But if you're being fed in other ways, then it's appropriate to give to other organizations as well. All part of the church.
All right, let's go on to a question from Drew Kinneman. Is art subjective? It appears for art to be objective, it must be grounded in the nature of God, like morality. Does morality have anything to do with art?
Well, I don't know if it to be objective, it has to be grounded in the nature of God. I'm not sure I even understand what that means. Morality is a command that creates obligation for us to obey. And those particular and that kind of thing is the nature of which is held between persons. Obligations are held between individuals, obedience, etc. And then the question is, what makes a good thing good? This is Euthyphro's dilemma, and it isn't God's raw command. The commands of God are grounded in his nature, which is unchanging and perfectly good. So there's a sense in which morality has a unique attachment to God. Now, aesthetics, though, are different, and that's what is pleasing to the eye or to the ear, that which is beautiful. I do not think that aesthetics are strictly subjective. I think that there are things that are beautiful in themselves, and those are things that like music, art, faces, the character. Character that's beautiful, though, is grounded in morality, and so that would be a little different category. A person can be beautiful on the inside, you know, but that's because of their moral virtues, and virtues are beautiful, but they are moral. These other things, though, I'm not sure exactly how to characterize it. The statement, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, I think is not strictly true, although there's something going on there. That is, people have different preferences. But most people when they have different preferences, they have different preferences for beautiful things. You don't have some people that prefer what everybody considers beautiful, but then you have some people who really, really like ugly things. They love discordant music that makes no sense and has no organization. It's just a cacophony of sound. Oh, it's so pleasant to listen to that. It lifts my spirits, all that. No, when they produce music like that, and some, there have been people who do that. I'm trying to think, who is the guy? I didn't even know this. I recognized the guy's name from like the 70s or whatever. He's a very popular guy, but he was just totally iconoclastic that way. Just made a bunch of noise. Very popular kind of rock guy. I can't think of his name right now, but I wasn't really in that culture. Can you, Amy?
No.
But a lot of those are philosophic statements. They're not meant to be beautiful. They are meant to assault beauty. And that's their philosophic statement. So I do think that that beauty, there are objective standards of beauty, just like there are objective standards of goodness. But to some degree, these things are primitive. And what I mean by primitive is that they kind of lay on the foundation of our knowledge, awareness. There's nothing underneath them that make them so. So what God is, God's nature is perfectly good. How do you know it's perfectly good? What is the exterior standard that qualifies God's goodness as goodness? Well, now then you do, the minute you do that, you ask, okay, if that's the standard, where did that standard come from? You're going to have to get at some point where you say, I recognize that. I can see that as a virtuous thing. And in the same way, I think we have beauty as a primitive. People can recognize beauty. There's a certain harmony to it. There's a certain balance to it. There's a certain structure to it visually. You have the golden mean, for example, and these are certain proportions that you see in Greek architecture, and these are the kinds of things that are beautiful. And when people go against those standards, like so-called postmodern architecture, and postmodernism started actually in architecture as a cultural expression, you see all these goofy buildings pointing in all these different ways. I've seen them on campus. They're ugly. They're just ugly. But it's meant to be a statement of nonconformity. However, they all conform to the building standards. So they don't fall down, which means they are operating within a within an objective standard of soundness, this architectural soundness. But in terms of the aesthetics, they're ugly. But they're meant to be. They're not meant to be beautiful. They're meant to be a statement against conventional things. And you see that a lot in art. That's what dystopian movies are about. That's nihilistic movies are about. Hollywood loves this kind of thing, which is why, by the way, Hollywood people, this is my assessment, this is why Hollywood people show up at grand affairs wearing, looking like tramps. They're wearing all kinds of trampy clothes. And what they're doing is they're trying to say, I'm not living by your standards. Everybody else is wearing a tux. I'm wearing my pajamas. You know, put that in your pipe and smoke it. It'd be a nice way of saying what I think is really on their mind. So, you know, it's an act of rebellion.
I think you're right, Greg, that artwork now, today, is not about trying to capture beauty. Whereas in the past, I think that was a goal. And I actually do think that beauty, objective beauty, does have something to do with the nature of God. Because I think it's very hard to separate goodness, truth, and beauty.
Mm-hmm. Those all are the classic three things, you know, with the good, the right, the true.
Right. And all of which
the good, the right, the beautiful, rather. Yeah.
And all of which are
characteristics.
They're from God. I mean, those things, you're only as good, true, and beautiful as you compare to who God is. And so that's what I think historically people were reaching out for, that perfection with art to try and capture something. And that was true about the ultimate goodness and the ultimate beauty. And like you said, Greg, that's not what people are doing now. And so it's kind of a different thing. But I think there is an objective thing because I think it is grounded in God's nature. So, for example, and like you also said, this doesn't mean that you will always enjoy the more beautiful thing, the more objectively beautiful thing. I mean, we do have our preferences, But if you're saying that your child's artwork, which you enjoy more than, say, Rembrandt's artwork, if you're actually saying that is better than Rembrandt's artwork and more beautiful than Rembrandt's artwork, people are going to tell you you're wrong because you are objectively wrong.
Yeah.
And so I think...
No, people are going to say, who's Rembrandt? Unfortunately.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
So there is, I think preference is different from objective beauty. And so, but I think we even know that. Nobody will actually say that they really truly believe their child's artwork is more beautiful than
it's just
one of these great
they're
masters.
Emoting at that point, and they're also trying to encourage their child, you know, yeah. Which is understandable. I think sometimes it gets to a point where it doesn't help. I mean, as kids grow up, sometimes you got to say, you know what, that's not so hot, and you could do a lot better than this. You want to develop your craft. You had a good start. Okay, keep working on it. Anyway.
Well, hopefully that helps you out, Drew. Did you have anything else to add, Greg, before I...
Yeah, I do. And this is a little sidetrack, but it had to do with that God being the grounding of truth. And I hear people say things like, God is the creator of truth. And I think that's an imprecise way of talking about it. Now, obviously, if God says something about the world, then what he says is true. Because God never lies. He gets it right all the time. He's omniscient. He knows all things, and he knows and believes all true propositions, and he doesn't lie. All right. So I guess you could say he's creating truth in such a way, in that kind of thing. That is, he's creating language that is true. But actually what's going on is he's creating something that is so. And this is the case with the whole world. God creates the universe, which is something about which true things can be said. He isn't creating the truth of the universe. He is creating the universe about which true things can be said. Now, this gets to the definition of what truth is. And what truth is simply a relationship between a belief or a statement and the object that the belief or statement is about. And if you say that it is and it is, or if you say that it isn't and it isn't, then that's true. That's Aristotle's way of putting it, but it's a very simple way of capturing a common sense notion. Truth isn't kind of just, in the way that we normally use it, just hanging out there, creating truth. No, God created a world, and then we can say two things about it. And then God tells us the nature of reality, and everything that God tells us about reality is true. The reality of himself, the reality of morality, the reality of the physical world, the reality of the non-physical world, everything God tells us is true because it's accurate to the way the world actually is, and it's accurate because he knows the way it is and he made the way it is, at least in its initial condition. Now it's fallen, of course, but he also knows that.
This is why, Greg, this is why I say it's so hard to distinguish between goodness, truth, and beauty, because truth is beautiful. Hopefully everyone has experienced a moment when you have found something to be true and you get that feeling of awe, and maybe not everyone feels this, but when you see something that is true, there's a certain quality to that that is beautiful. And the same is true for goodness. And the same is true for people who are trying to project beauty, because usually they are trying to project some idea of goodness or some idea of truth. So you could have a painting that's not, maybe it's a very sad painting, and maybe it's a painting of death, but it might capture something true about it that makes it beautiful. So they're all so connected. I think what people are trying to do when they're trying to create beauty, they're trying to capture that thing that we all long for, which is God, which is being with God. Lewis talks about this, this whole idea of kind of this longing for this, for something. And he talks about these tastes that he had of beauty.
Right. When he was very young, right.
Those are tastes of God, of who God is, and our desire to be with him, because we were created to be with him. And so this creation of beauty is trying to capture a little bit of who God is.
Mm-hmm.
And that can involve goodness, truth, and just aesthetic beauty.
Yeah, I was thinking of another kind of art. I'm thinking especially of the very famous painting that many people have seen. It's called The Scream. And it's a kind of a, you know, a surreal picture of a man's head that's expressing screaming and expressing terror. But that is meant to communicate the angst and the hopelessness and the extreme terror of nihilism, of being in an empty world that has no meaning and there is no God, and what's left, it's just absolutely terrifying. So the painting is, well, it's not exactly beautiful, although it is fetching in its artistic expression. It's not beautiful in a sense like, oh, that's really sweet. But it's capturing something true. Mm-hmm. When there is no God, this is what you're left with. Nihilistic hopelessness, mind-bending despair. And it captures that in the thing. And I think some of the dystopian movies, like No Place for Old Men, for example, is one of those which got a Best Picture one year. These are movies that that trade on the idea of complete hopelessness and emptiness and nihilism, nothingism. But that's exactly what one is left with in a world without God.
All right. Well, I hope that was helpful to you, Drew, and thank you, everyone, again for your questions. We hope to hear from you on Twitter with the hashtag STRAsk. This is Amy Hall and Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason.